internet is the long-awaited information age, and I think we're in for a whole new generation, a whole new era of economic expansion based on connecting the world together. My worst fears are that it won't happen, that somehow we're going to bollocks this all up. I think, for example, the internet's going to go into remission soon. It's going to collapse in 96, at least temporarily. If I had to bet, though, I think it is going to come out the other side. My worst fear is that somehow we'll, through some notion of perfection, you know, wanting it to be perfect, we won't let it happen because it isn't perfect. It's quite imperfect.
Cyberspace pioneer Robert Metcalf. He'll be back in just a moment with more about information technology and life in the age of digital communications. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Last month, an important technological anniversary passed largely without fanfare. This was the 50th birthday of the first electronic numerical integrator and computer, a technical colossus that weighed 50 tons but was capable of remembering only 20 numbers. Listen now as a recent technological pioneer reflects on where we're headed on the information superhighway. Robert Metcalf writes about information technology for InfoWorld, an industry newspaper. But before becoming a cyberspace pundit, Robert Metcalf was a principal player in the development of digital communications technology. In 1973, he invented Ethernet, the technology that now connects almost 20 million computers around the globe and that served as one of the early models for the Internet and the World Wide Web. In a conversation recorded at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., I asked Robert Metcalf to talk about his role in the development of digital communications and their social implications in the 1990s.
Well, there were a lot of people involved and have been involved in the Internet over the years, and I can't imagine what was in all their heads. But where I was, I did have a personal sense of the notion of a technology crusader. Because I'd been involved, even at that young age, in crusading for new technologies. And let me give you two examples. When I first got involved with computers, they were these big mainframes that consumed cards, decks of cards, and batch processed them overnight. And then at MIT, I ran into a thing called time sharing, completely different way of using computers, interactively sharing the computer among many people all at the same time. And interactive time sharing became a crusade. And there were people who said it was a foolish thing and the research money should be withdrawn and it was a waste of computing resources. And others like me, all in a junior way, once again as a student, I thought I saw immediately the benefits of time sharing and interactivity and became a crusader for it. And you had to be a crusader because the conservative forces wanted you to stop wasting your time with this newfangled stuff. And it was a waste of government money and it was a waste of graduate student time. Then the personal computer was a crusade. You know, there were people, the then establishment felt that big computers were the better way to go. And there was a famous law called Grotius' Law, which said, in essence, the bigger the computer, the better. And personal computers were an affront to that law. And so there was another crusade where you had to go in public and, you know, when I say in public, I mean computer conferences, and take the position that personal computers are a good idea and have other people disparage you and face that criticism. And then came networking, which we became crusaders pretty early. I remember the conference in Washington in 1972 where we presented the ARPANET. It sort of came out after having worked on it for years. And I was still a bearded graduate student, and I was given the job of escorting 10 pinstriped AT&T executives around this exhibit we had here at the Washington Hilton. And it was clear to me after a few moments that these executives weren't rooting for the ARPANET. They were not here to celebrate the ARPANET. They were here because it was kind of a challenge to the world that they were familiar with. And I remember the ARPANET crashed in the middle of the demo I was giving to these 10 guys. And I looked up, horrified, and they were all happy about it. They were smiling. So there was a sense of crusade. You know, there was the people who sort of like it the old way and the people who like it the new way. And then so then you become a crusader if you sort of advanced. Of course, a lot of crusaders are wrong. You have to keep that in mind. And maybe I've just been fortunate to be on the right side of most of the crusades I've gotten involved in.
Bob Metcalf, we're talking about your work as a cyber pioneer, so to speak, the inventor of the Ethernet. How do we move from the Ethernet to the Internet?
The kind of networks that the Internet is a network of are Ethernets. That is, most of the subnetworks of the Internet are Ethernets. Ethernet is a local network system that connects computers in a building or adjacent buildings. And then in a big Ethernet, say at a university or a business, you would then have a box called a router, which takes data off that local network and then puts it out onto the Internet. So the Internet is a network of networks, and those networks are, for the most part, Ethernets.
Bob Metcalf, an old line from one of your sort of neighbors up there in the Northeast, Henry David Thoreau, comes to mind about the installation of the telegraph between Maine and Texas. He says, what if people don't want to talk to one another in Maine and Texas? Did you think in those terms at all when you were doing your number as an engineer and putting together computers and Ethernets? How much beyond the laboratory were you thinking? How deliberately were you inviting into the laboratory the sort of social pundits, the commentators, the critics who were talking about the social implications of what you were doing?
Well, I would say until recently, by recently I mean the last 5 years or so, I personally had very little interest in or patience with the humanistic side of what we were doing. Once again, I think I was encouraged in this belief because I had the general notion that technological advance, and particularly information technological advance, was beneficial in some general way. And having convinced myself of that somehow, I didn't reflect upon it every day. And there weren't, best as I recall, people in the orbit of those who built these networks who spent a lot of time on that. But in the last 5 years, my view has changed dramatically now. That is, the technology, the ARPANET, networking, the Internet, has come so far now. There are, say, 5 or 10 or 15, no one knows how many people are on the Internet, but there are now millions of people on the Internet. Suddenly it has major impact on the way people are thinking and on the social implications and threats to our civil liberties and how we live and the structure of commerce. And so now my attitude is flipped, and my general notion is to not that I'm going to become a humanist suddenly, but that humanists, you know, genuine humanists, had better get involved with this really quickly. But then I'm particular about how they get involved. The humanists sitting over there from afar, issuing their comments about the questionable nature of the Internet, say, and blah this and blah that, are a waste of time. We have to get humanists onto, all through the Internet so that they know whereof they speak. They have to get into the thick of it. So I take every opportunity like this one to invite humanists to get inside this Internet, because we need desperately now a reflection upon where it's going. And because where it's going is up to us. I mean, we get to decide to a large degree where it goes.
Bob, where is the leadership coming from if not from the humanistic community? I mean, you have private citizens, you have the government at work, you have commercial concerns, people who want to make a lot of money using the Internet.
Well, now you're getting into politics and philosophy, and the Internet is a big phenomenon, and so there are roles for everybody. There's roles for government, there's roles for commerce, there's role for enthusiasts. I tend to be an enthusiast. I'm pro-technology, and naturally I do, because I work on technology, I must be pro-technology. I think the internet is entering a phase where the most trustworthy source of leadership will come from commerce. That is, if the government clings to the internet as an information superhighway, like it's just like the transportation superhighway, only it's now the information superhighway, and the government tries to run it that way. And by the way, the government is not generally threatening to do that, but if they accidentally change their mind, that would be a bad development. I think the government's role in the internet has been very positive over the last 25 years, but of course governments have a way of overdoing it, and as I said, I think the most trustworthy leadership will come from people pursuing it for financial, for profit.
Well, if you want to be so rosy in your view of the effects of capitalism, unchecked, as it were, on the internet, how do we prevent on the internet the sort of sorry state that we see when we look at a conventional mass telecommunications in the United States? That is to say, the networks delivering on their promises, they have a very checkered past when it comes, for example, to serving children.
Well, I'm one of those people who doesn't think television is all that bad. There's a lot of junk on it, no doubt. In fact, a high percentage of it is junk. And we let our children watch television advisedly only for very short periods of time every week. But that system has produced a lot of good television if you look for it. You have to look for it. If you just turn on the TV and watch what comes over, you're going to get junk. But if you scour the indices and look for what you want, you can find good stuff on television. But that being, just to attack the premise of your question for a moment, but getting back to the internet, I think advertising, which is how television is generally paid for, and not to mention newspapers and magazines, advertising is going to be an increasing source of revenue on the internet. And so it's reasonable for people to be concerned that the internet will go the way of television, whether they think that's a terrible way or only a bad way. And I do think advertising will be one of the ways in which we pay for the internet, a rising source of funds, but not the only source of funds, and I think that's where the important difference will come. The internet, unlike television, has the means for fine-grained commerce. I call it micro-money, where digital transactions, in particular for intellectual property, can be conducted efficiently, so that you don't have to rely entirely on advertising support for what you want out of the internet, that there will be the means for buying things that you want, paying for them rather than have an advertiser pay for them. We call this digital cash, digital money, micropayments. I call it micro money. It doesn't matter what you call it, but the idea is to, on the internet, have the way to buy things that you want and things that are very cheap. For example, I write a column for a newspaper. I'd love to be able to sell that column for a penny or a tenth of a penny. You want to read my column, you pay a tenth of a penny. Now, today, in today's world, you can't afford to pay a tenth of a penny for anything. But on the internet, you can, when the technology is developed and the standards are developed and the systems are put in place. It will be practical to buy things for a tenth of a penny or a hundredth of a penny or 50 cents or 25 cents, micro payments, very small things. And I think this is going to set off a boom in intellectual property, where they'll, with these additional means of financing the development of intellectual property, information, we'll have much more of it, and we'll be able to pay for it directly rather than rely on the indirect means of having it paid for just by advertising. The internet is a million channels. That is, with interactivity, you get to choose with very fine-grained structure what it is you want to see, and it becomes economical for shows or information to be developed for very small audiences because of the interactivity. With the broadcast medium, it's much harder to zero in, but for an interactive medium, you can have a million channels, and those channels don't have to have large audiences to be sustainable.
Bob, what about the question of equality on the internet, in the political sense and in the social sense?
Well, on the internet, this issue is often known as the haves and the have-nots, the info haves and the info have-nots, and it's a phrase and a cause and an issue which drives me crazy. It appears to be There are many sincere people involved, and I don't wish to be critical of them, but it appears to be an issue which is generally a justification for bad things, like because we have the have-nots, we need to have the government come in and fix that and be sure that nobody ever does anything on the internet unless those have-nots are being watched out for. And that perhaps I'm revealing a little bit of my ideology here, but I think the best way to take care of the have-nots is to have the internet proceed in an open, competitive marketplace. There is the other complication that if you offered the internet to one of these have-not people that we hear so much about, the internet's probably not what they would want. Would you like a warm place to live and a good education, or would you like a free month on the internet? I think I know what they'd choose, these have-nots. So I guess I'm expressing frustration at that particular issue. The way we have such high-quality food and such choice in food is we have these supermarkets killing each other in a competitive marketplace, and I think that's the same mechanism we should use to get the internet available to huge numbers of people as soon as possible. That's by creating a vibrant, commercial, competitive environment so that that's the best way to drive it to the largest number of people as soon as possible. And then, if you want to take care of the have-nots, give them internet vouchers. Don't insist, that to be an internet provider, you must provide services for the have-nots. That's what I would call an unfunded mandate to the telcos, and it distorts competition horribly. If you want to help the have-nots, in particular like schools and libraries, which are two of my favorites, you need to give them the money directly so they can go out onto the open market and buy from competitive suppliers.
Bob Metcalf, let's talk about American education and cyberspace. It's a kind of an either-or thing in the press. Either it's going to be the salvation of our educational system, or it's going to be simply another series of toys that won't really make any difference to the way kids learn. Those are two extremes.
Well, education is one of my priorities. I have a lot of it myself, and I believe in it. And if this have versus have-nots issue resonates with me anywhere, it's in the area of education, where we need to have a highly educated populace, period, the end. Now, is the internet the salvation of our current educational system? And I say no. Particularly K-12 education in the United States is horribly broken, and introducing the internet into the public school system is not going to fix it. And I'm doing that now. I'm working on that, trying to get hands-on experience with that myself right now. But just introducing the internet is not going to fix that system. It's broke, and it needs to be fixed fundamentally. The broadening of horizons, I think, will be the principal contribution of the internet, putting people in touch with remote and distant places so that they don't only see the horizons presented by their local community or even the school they're in, but they can look outside and see. And when they can look outside of their local environment, then they can, their horizons suitably broadened, they can have higher ambitions and see ways to succeed, and it's a liberating thing. I think the internet will eventually be a very positive impact, have a very positive impact on education. It's just that quite separate and apart from the issue of the internet, we have to fix the educational system too. Let's not think that the internet's going to be the solution.
Bob, where is the next generation of Robert Metcalfs going to come from? Do you feel a sense of confidence about the next platoon, the next wave of engineers, graduate students, curious young people who are going to be doing in cyberspace between now and, 2050, 2025, what you were doing back in the late 1960s and the early 1970s?
Well, I'm worried about that. I'm a product of the public school system, and the public school system has been going downhill since I was the last good class to graduate from my high school. Ha-ha. I'm also a product of the research universities, MIT in my case. And right now, in what's going on in our reconsideration of how we're going to run our federal government, the research universities, which are sort of the top of the food chain in education and research, are threatened. mostly in the way that, mostly not that we're cutting, I think a lot of cutting is necessary, but the way we're cutting, you know, bureaucracies have a funny way of cutting their budgets, and we need to be mindful of that. So I'm worried about the health of the major research universities, of which I'm a product. And then I'm also a product of corporate research, because I went from MIT to Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and U.S. corporations have had two difficulties. One is a lot of them have been gutted recently, the last 5 years or so. And in that process of suffering competitive collapse, they have lost their taste for long-term research. I think that can be fixed, should be fixed. How we're going to fix it, I don't know. One brilliant idea is to somehow get the major corporations that have conducted most of the healthy research connected up to the research universities. Maybe the New Deal isn't between the government and the research universities. Maybe the New Deal is between corporate research and the major research universities. And anyway, I am worried about how that's going to sort out and how, because I went to school for 23 years and had the benefit of going to, of being in some of the best places. And all the places that I've been are under attack. So, not that they're perfect. I mean, they need fixing, but they are under attack. And so it's reasonable to worry about whether they'll come out the other side.
Bob, let's talk about a couple of very specific social issues with respect to the internet, cyberspace. One of them would be privacy, flow of information.
Well, it's right to be concerned that information networks will somehow affect our privacy or the balance of privacy. And unfortunately, when discussing this subject about the internet, people seem to think that we live currently in a world without the internet where our privacy is perfectly protected. But somehow, when the internet arrives, this personal privacy, which we now enjoy, is going to be penetrated by the internet. I'd like to correct both of those mistaken notions. A, we don't live in a very private world as it is, and so it's a little unfair to compare we give our credit cards to total strangers and they disappear around corners and they come back and give us the credit cards back and we don't think twice about it. So we don't live in a totally private world as it is. And second of all, I think the internet offers an opportunity for us to improve the level of personal privacy that we enjoy. That is, there are technologies, well-known technologies, that could easily be applied in the internet to actually increase the level to which our personal information is kept private, our personal communications are kept private. So I see the internet as an opportunity to actually improve on the situation, on the notion of privacy.
Bob, when we read about cyberspace and the internet in the newspapers, and many times when we see this term on television, we see it associated with controversies over freedom of speech, pornography, the real sort of flashpoints in our culture. Now, is that appropriate? I'm not suggesting that these aren't things that we shouldn't worry about, but should we worry about them specifically with regard to the internet in ways that we don't worry about them or do worry about them with regard to conventional methods of distribution of information or entertainment?
I think I agree with you that the censorship freedom of speech issue has been overblown of late. There is an issue there, and it's a thorny one, but it's been a thorny one even out before the internet. The difficulty being that so many people who have opinions about censorship and freedom of speech don't know anything about the internet is our real problem. And they try to straightforwardly apply what they've learned in print and broadcast and try to apply it to the internet and mix things up. On the other hand, I think the internet is far too resilient to let that stop it. And even if some laws get passed that censor the internet, I'm sure the internet will get around them. And then new laws will have to be passed that fix the problem. The issue is overblown. I think there are tools that will let parents control what their children see, and I think parents, in order to exercise their responsibilities, need to have that control. On the other hand, I think that consenting adults should be able to say whatever they want to each other, and that's true on the internet as it's true anywhere else, should be true. And there are the technological means, encryption, for example, that will make that a reality. That is, that people will be able to say anything they want to each other, and no one will know, and that's good, I think.
Bob Metcalf, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Who is the Internet for?
The Internet is for everybody. I mean, it's like asking who's the telephone for or who's the television for. I would qualify my answer in only this way, which is the Internet is now too expensive and too hard to use, and that will be off-putting to a lot of people. But it hasn't been off-putting to senior citizens. I've, in my own experience and also some of the research I've seen, senior citizens have two things that a lot of other people don't have. They have money and they have time on their hands. And so whenever people attempt research on the demographics of Internet users, there's always this little blip out there on the senior end of things. So senior citizens are getting on the Internet in a surprising way. No, I think it's for everybody as the prices come down and as it becomes easier to use. Right now, it is reasonable to say, I don't want to have anything to do with it because it's too expensive and too hard to use. And I think that reason cuts across demographics. And as the Internet improves and as we package it better and as we make it cheaper, I think it's for everybody, like television, like telephone.
Robert Metcalf is executive correspondent for InfoWorld. He also serves on the board of trustees at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In the early 1970s, he pioneered digital communications by inventing Ethernet, one of the early models for the Internet and the World Wide Web. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Audio cassettes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 809. That's $10, program number 809. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week, literary scholar Lillian First. She calls herself an Anne Frank who survived. Lillian First will be here to talk about her new book, Home is Somewhere Else, an account of her family's escape from the Holocaust. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.